Hello, and welcome to The Regrettable Century. This week, we are continuing part two of our discussion with C. Derek Varn on Marxism and ethics. If you haven't yet listened to part one, please go back and do that now. And as always, remember to check out our comrades on the Lost Horizons Network, Red Library and From 78, and look out for our very irregularly posted Network Roundtable podcast. And if you feel so inclined, head on over to our Patreon, sign up for $2, get access to our patron-only content, our patron roundtables, and help us come up with ideas of what to do. Anyway, enjoy the show.
So old Georgia B, in his Marx's Ethics of Freedom, the first note I took out of that, I think I really like it. And it does amount to me kind of like overdoing it on this one point at this point. So I'm going to do what Blackledge does in his essay. But I like that he says that if Marxism were a science without an ethics, it's unclear how we're supposed to understand the notion that communism will constitute a higher phase of existence for humanity, that there is a progressive nature to history, and that communism will initiate a true realm of freedom. Like, just, you know, just to really underscore the point that there is, that even though Marx does not have a, he is not a moral philosopher, he does not have a, he hasn't formulated a moral theory. He very clearly is motivated by some sense of morals, or some sense of ethics. Because, like, you know, the great debate about the mature Marx versus the young Marx, I think is silly. You know, the idea that, like, you know, old Marx is basically just trying to, like, he's just in the lab trying to figure out the formula for capitalism, just to understand it. And I think that the young Marx, right, the idealist Hegelian Marx, who's concerned about freedom, I don't think that goes away. I think that capital basically doesn't make sense unless you understand it as a project, capital the book. If you don't understand it as part of the project of trying to, you know, participate in the attainment of freedom, I don't know what it's for, other than as a, you know, because it's not like a biology text. It's not just like knowledge so that we have a better understanding of the world around us. And also, like, you know, you have to situate the project of writing Capital, and thus of like studying, you know, political economy and poring over statistics and getting the mathematical formulas wrong a lot, as Engels points out in his translation, his compilation, right? But like, you have to situate that within founding the First International, and speaking to trying to help agitate strikes of workers to, for, you know, not just for better conditions, but also to like refuse to process cotton from the American South as part of an anti-slavery campaign. You know, like, Marx's life is completely seeped in, you know, these sort of abstract struggles for freedom that are not abstract at all. They're actually like deeply material. And I think that these two things are so obviously related in a way that it really doesn't, none of it makes sense to me if you try to separate them.
Agreed.
Yeah. Okay. I think I've always thought it was a bit silly to make this hard line between old Marx and young Marx. That said, there are, I mean, a biology textbook is like teaching people to, you know, understand the world in a certain aspect, things about the world, so that they can go out and then like work in that area of science, which is doing something, acting on the world in some way. Now, it's not driven by you know, the desire to overturn the class structure of society. It's driven by, like, you know, individuals' desire to make a living, getting paid a salary to do something for a company that has a desire to maximize its profits, or a government agency that has a desire to enact some policy or whatever it is. But you know,
I thought you were drawing a comparison between those as being equivalent, but now I recognize that you were actually just drawing a distinction between them as being opposites.
Well, I mean, I was trying to drive at there's maybe more of a similarity than you initially allowed for.
Oh, okay.
But it's irrelevant. So.
Thank you.
Well, I'll try to get us back, swing us back towards virtue ethics a little bit harder.
Yeah, so let's talk about why any of this would imply virtue ethics, right? We talked a little bit about the plurality means that the virtues that you choose can change. The other thing that you would say, and this is McIntyre, and I'm just going to read McIntyre here. This is from What Morality Is Not. It is widely held that it is the essence of moral evaluations that they are universalizable and prescriptive. This is a contention which I wish to deny. McIntyre list, and now I'm reading from a source of all knowledge, not Wikipedia. McIntyre lists the six kinds of moral evaluations that are neither universalizable nor prescriptive, and concludes that a theory of universal prescriptivism is inadequate for the same reason that emotivism is inadequate. It is overly reductive. Universal prescriptivism simply fails to give a complete account of what we mean by moral judgments, even in the common language terms. So why would that matter for us, right? How can we say that morality or ethical norms are not totally relativistic? Because if you really believe that, there really is no reason to critique a society other than, I feel like it.
Because maybe you're bored.
Yeah. Or if you're Nietzsche, you're bitter because, you know, you're a weakling and you don't want to be a weakling anymore. So you're going to trick people.
That's my whole project. Just to trick people into thinking I'm not a weakling.
We'll see. The slave morality. But what I find interesting about this is that it gives you something like a non-relativistic pluralism, which would be adaptable to a humanity that exists in constantly changing social and natural circumstances. So that gets you out of one problem. But it creates, I don't want to sound like it doesn't create a bunch of other problems. I mean, because one of the things you have to get into is how do you pick your fucking virtues? Like, McIntyre eventually just goes, oh, I don't know, God, still, because, you know, God.
Well, he never really answers the question in this book, does he? Mm-mm. I mean, I know that is a Thomist, or that's what
he meant. Basically, he gets to the point where, like, okay, to maintain my argument, God. which is why I think whoever suggested we talk about Philippa Foot is actually interesting, because Foot is one of the few people, I think, to really try to, even though both her and McIntyre, as a side note, will deny they are virtue ethicists, are so sneaky bastards.
That's Foot attempting to lay out a system is good. I think it leaves a little bit to be desired, but she actually died before she was able to finish writing what she wanted to write. I think she was on her trajectory. And she was like 90 something when she died too, but you know. I think that to apply virtue ethics using Marxist system, right? Like, what would a Marxist virtue ethics look like? And where could we derive virtues from within that system? And I think that Foote provides us with a little bit of a window of what it would look like. But we would have to come up, we're going to have to nail this down before we get offline tonight.
Yeah, this group is going to determine the criteria for what constitutes a Marxist virtue ethics.
We're
going to
solve that tonight, guys. Don't worry.
Like Lukács, you know, he just says, and I think this is actually really like inadequate, that class consciousness is the ethics of the proletariat.
Yeah, whatever.
It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, well, I mean, proletarian virtue ethics doesn't even make sense to me when you're talking about the goal. This is where like I start sounding like a communizer for those of you who follow super ultra left theories. But like, if the goal is class abolition, reifying the ethics of the proletariat as it exists right now is stupid.
Yeah.
Because
right. Well, I think that what you could possibly do to bridge that gap though is to say, let's look at what virtues did the bourgeoisie uphold as it ascended? It didn't reify itself as it currently existed. It reified its aspirations.
Mm-hmm.
world, what the world ought to look like for it. And I think we can bridge that gap for the and say the same for the proletariat, that the proletariat aspires toward certain virtues and the world ought to look like a certain way for it.
Like this, the term I'm going to get wrong, but egoist, whatever, individualist ethical constructs are universalized as the bourgeoisie is an ascendant class. And they're, you know, that they kind of remake they reframe the way that we understand the world and our place in it as individuals. Now that redounds to the benefit of the capitalist class, but they don't say it does. And they probably don't even, I mean, I don't think they think it does.
No,
but it does. Right. And so
I mean, it turns on itself.
Like for Marx, when we talk about, he doesn't really so much talk about like capitalism and socialism is on the way to communism or whatever. These are kind of like weirder, simplest simplifications, but he talks about a private mode of production and a collective mode of production. And, you know, capitalism is the system that has been generated by that private mode of production. And communism is the process by which we overcome it. So if we think we should overcome it, now it's a big if, right? We have to construct all the reasons why we need to overcome it. But if we need to, then a basis for the ethics for a whatever communist ethics is anything in service of or not anything, but you know, it would be at its root in service of overcoming private mode of production and in favor of the collective one.
Another thing I would point out to that, just in going from the critique of the Goethe program, despite like the whole Hegelian critique of gradualism, and by that I don't mean like reformism. I mean Hegel has a problem with the concept of gradualism. Marx does not think you can have a singular hard split between societies. It is pretty clear in Critique of the Goethe program that the whole right. stages thing is not really because you need stages, but because there is not a singular moment where you can say, during the process of becoming, you know, a classless society, or during the process of privatizing the mode of production, in the case of capitalism, there's not one single moment where you can say it happened. And like this realization,
centuries even maybe.
Yeah, it's centuries, and we can argue over which centuries it was. Like,
it definitely takes place between the 1400s and the 1800s.
Right, but. But even if you look at, for example, Gyrus Banerjee's argument, I think I finally pronounced his name right, about capitalism, that he saw something that even I noticed. Like if you look at late antique society, you have everything you need for capitalism right there, and it doesn't happen. And if you look again during the beginnings of the Black Plague, you had everything you need for capitalism sporadically in certain monastic communities, and it didn't happen. Now there's this group of MMTers who sound weirdly like McIntyre, who now argue that like our concept of individuated universal money is a breach from our concept of the universal sovereign good as developed by Sir Thomas Aquinas, and that John Scotus introduced individualism and the Franciscans by accident, thus creating capitalism. That one's a fun new theory that you'll hear these days.
Huh.
By MMTers of all things, because of they have a chartalist view of the state. And I want to go into that right now because that'll take another 2 hours. But that there is some truth to the fact that, yeah, the aspirations of the bourgeoisie, they produce a certain set of values that themselves reify them in a certain way and actually undo themselves. Like this is the other point about Marx is like, from the boom, like from the Renaissance forward, whenever capitalism is in crisis, all of its virtues will be turned on itself and it will start resembling the forms that existed priorly. The Vermeer.
That.
Yeah.
You could argue that fascism is the resurrection of pre-liberal, not post-liberal forms.
Well, you can argue right now, for example, that the whole rentier economy is actually a hint at regressing to elements of feudalism.
Sure. Yeah. It looks more like a pre-revolutionary France, where it's not exactly feudal, but it's more feudal than it's not.
Or right. It looks like the feudalizing process that's happening during the fall of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
So what does that say about virtues? Okay, so we talk about virtues again.
Back to virtues.
All these virtues are bound. But one thing that you would argue from Marxism, just like you would argue about ideas, right? That anyone can think any idea. Like Marx doesn't think that – I don't think Marx thinks that everybody's so conditionally bound by the mode of production that they literally cannot think thoughts outside of that mode of production because, A, we got textual evidence that that's full of shit, and, B, I just – like that would also make Marx's own position impossible if you really think about it. So like – what I think Marx is actually on about is that certain thoughts are irrelevant until mm-hmm. you have a way to attach them to social reproduction and those modes of production. Right. And so, like, if we look at early liberal virtues, there are more that were posited than survived the Enlightenment. If you just go back and look at your fun radicals and all this, and your bourgeois radicals, like there's all kinds of systems that are proposed. Which ones survive? State right, of nature thoughts, methodological individualism, universal deductive rules, reductive morality, singular rule things, emotivism, etc.
Right, individualism, and in particular, negative freedom. Which is the lack of restrictions on one's options,
right?
Which is supposed to be counterposed to positive freedom being empowerment to achieve one's aims,
right? But even that's not articulated in that way till after it's way after it's already happened, because you don't even have that like articulated till like Isaiah Berlin.
Yeah.
So like,
exactly. Yeah, it's more of a recognition of established fact than it is
right.
Like,
bingo.
Yeah.
So, but when you go back and look at, like when I used to argue with libertarians back when I would deign to do such a stupid thing.
Say this when you had a lot more free time on your hands.
Like, yeah. And also they were around me a lot more. I would point out that like when they would claim classical liberalism, I'd be like, well, everybody's a classical liberal by that definition. I mean, even fucking Marxists are in their critique of liberalism because we all emerge out of this set of values, unless you're literally a person who somehow believes that there is a viable way to go back to, I don't know, the Byzantine Empire, like you are emergent from liberalism and claiming
you're crushing my dreams now. That's what I wanted to do.
What's the point in that? Is again back to talking about this in terms of virtues. Our virtues would one of the reasons why virtue ethics seems more compelling than to a Marxist as a way to ground your ethics, one is because I think Marx basically just assumed it. Like, I think it is the assumption of, because it's exactly kind of an assumption in Hegel. And exactly. Two.
Isn't that what Terry says about Marxist ethics as well?
Yeah.
He's briefly mentioned in one of the articles we read. So I looked him up a little bit further and I watched a video of him talking about it. And he basically says that Marx implies that virtue ethics exists and that the guiding principle of those ethics is the from each according to his ability to each according to his needs statement.
Right.
But that's all I saw. That's all I could find on Hegel in saying that.
I mean, that is a reasonable sort of encapsulation of the unconscious or implicit virtue ethics in Marx's thought.
Yeah.
Like that is like, you know, if you could, you know, you could sum it up in those words that, like, if you were going to teach, you know, Kant thought this and Hobbes thought this, and then this is what Marx thought, that would be the thing that Marx thought.
Right. I mean, as you contrast that to someone like Lukács, who has like the ethics of the proletariat as its consciousness, and its consciousness is basically whatever it acts both in itself and for itself. The problem with that is it's circular.
I was going to say it's super convenient because it can expand or contract based on whatever's happening. It doesn't.
Well,
it doesn't,
I mean, like, me, as much as I respect what Lukács was trying to do, is he's basically trying to come up with a critical theory that applies Marx to something beyond political economy, Lukács basically kills Marxism as having any substance, which is why I find it hilarious that people who want to prove their Marxist bona fides will call themselves Orthodox Marxists, because that's something that comes out of Lukács. And what Lukács does to come up with orthodoxy is say, Marxism is a methodology. What is that methodology? Whatever the proletariat does in and for itself.
Right. And then,
which means it isn't anything at all, but what is what the proletariat does, I guess.
Well, Lukács, then he further complicates his own, let's say his own system of ethics there by, really, really deeply elaborating on the concept of false consciousness, which, following from the first proposition, false consciousness would be the equivalent in Lukács' system of like sin or immorality.
Right.
Because if ethics is class consciousness, then false consciousness would be its opposite, which would mean it would be unethical. It would be, and then there's like a, it becomes something different than an obstacle. It's kind of like it's kind of equivalent to like how the old Communist Party used to say that race prejudice is an obstacle to unity among the class, which means you can't struggle together and win and thus overthrow capitalism. And today's left says that racism is a moral failing of the individual, that there's something like implicitly wrong with you in your brain and in your heart and in your soul.
Today's left actually believes both things. Like, unfortunately, they believe two impossibly incoherent things, that racism is structural, but also it's your bigotry that is driving it and your relation to it that matters.
I think that most people, when they say the word structural, they just mean pervasive.
Yeah, I would think that I think that's probably more right. They mean
basically
systemic. As in it is felt system-wide rather than systemic in the sense of it being intrinsic to the functioning of. Yeah.
They basically think of racism and the structure as sort of like the force and midichlorians, you know? if you act racist, then you're putting out the racism midichlorians that altogether bind the racism structure. So if you would just quit being racist, you would subtract your midichlorians from the fucking racism force. And it would eventually die out if everyone's like would quit doing that. Dumb example, but that's literally what people
say. No, that makes a lot of sense, actually.
And if you listen to bands that have like a problematic member, they're actually getting their midichlorians on everyone else and then projecting that everyone else.
Right, it gets into your brain, yeah.
It does. The racism magic gets in you and makes you racist.
Well, and look, to follow the implications of that kind of thinking, and there are people who are like on the left or whatever that can do this. Where you can go back to some of the stuff that somebody like Marx said, and find that it's deeply problematic and cancelable, and actually calls into question the very foundations of the thing that he's trying to do in the first place. Because Marx is a product of his time and place. Victorian England, he's got some unethical positions, but he's driven by a set of ethics. They're even in contradiction with each other. But I think that's okay. I don't have to do everything and think everything that he thought, but I do agree with him.
Well,
especially
I mean,
the contradictions.
Yeah. No, the contradictions are badass.
One of the things that maybe we can get back to another element of virtue ethics in both Foote and McIntyre here, though, is what you're getting at here is the emotivism of all this. Now, we can claim to have a structural analysis. We can claim to have, but what we know in interacting with people, what actually is going on in a lot of these things is not a structural. If you've ever sat through a woke and anti-woke fight, what is driving that is not a structural analysis of wokeness and a structural analysis of race and class reductionism or whatever. It is my friends think your friends are stupid and racist, and your friends think my friends are bad and evil and wrong. And so what you actually have is an emotive post facto justification for a social distinction. some, you know, there are, that is not, it is not to say that there aren't substantive reasons for the emotions, but you have no way to arbitrate between them, which is why the signaling, you know, McIntyre points this out. The signaling of all this stuff is not for any kind of moral deliberation or convincing or even reconciliation. It is signaling ownership to other people. That is not to say that it is good or bad, but it is to say that it is emotive, right, and about emotive belonging, and can shift on a dime.
Right.
Like, what is or is not, and we all know this, what is or is not counselable. What is or is not, you know, what argument we're going to make against the woke people? Because I don't want to just make it sound like it's the woke people on this. This is, there's a certain anti-woke left that is,
oh yeah,
just as bad or worse.
Exactly. Yeah. They are a perfect inversion of the woke left. That it is still a culture war for them. They're just on the opposite side of it, you know.
Right. It's a culture war in which what do they mean by fucking culture? Like. Hmm. Like, it's not...
They mean the aggregate of individual sentiments.
Bingo. They mean the aggregate of individual sentiments, not something emergent from individuals in a way that is not just aggregated.
Right. Some being more than the, you know, whatever the... What's that fucking phrase? I can never say it right. The whole is more than the sum of the parts. There we go.
Yeah. McIntyre says this is, what is it? What does he say? It's that these are really just feelings when we talk about these, you know, these ethical standards. It's really just feelings.
Yeah. So to clarify, that's what McIntyre is talking about with emotivism is that is the claim or the school of thought that says that all that ethical statements are statements of approval or disapproval about actions. And there is no truth value underlying.
Right.
Underlying these statements, there is only this is good, which translates approximately to I approve of this, you should also.
Well, if that sounds like
Nietzsche, or do to likewise,
that sounds like Nietzsche to you, it does for a reason. But I would also say, it's also a standard assumption in analytic philosophy, despite you know, analytics' pretensions to objective truth.
Yeah.
When you talk to most analytics, they actually treat ethics as a form of aesthetics, which is, for them, an arbitrary category of pleasure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. There was the argument that McIntyre made that I fucking just, I absolutely loved it. It's lodged itself in my brain where he sort of responded to this by saying, yes, there is an emotivism going on when people make ethical claims frequently, oftentimes, even most of the time. But that doesn't mean that that's the only thing contained in there. That doesn't mean that there isn't a truth value to the claim this is good and this is bad. And he gives a parallel example by saying a student in a class, or there's a teacher in a classroom, and the teacher says, calls on a student, says, Johnny, what's 2 + 2? And Johnny says, 2 + 2 = 5. And the teacher responds to Johnny, no, 2 + 2 = 4. Now, contained in that statement is an instruction of this is, I approve of this answer, I disapprove of that answer, you should likewise. But what is also contained in there is a statement with a truth value. It is the case that 2 + 2 = 4. And that is, there's both senses are going on inside the sentence at the same time. So just to point out that emotivism is happening a lot of the time when people are making ethical claims doesn't mean that there isn't anything else to ethics.
At first I was wondering where you're going with that at first, but that is a really good, that's an important point that, that these two things can coexist. They don't necessarily, they are not mutually antagonistic, even if, I might have a preference for one over the other.
Right. I mean, and actually, Foote, I'm going to get Foote to bring Foote back into this. Foote talks about this, not in something that you guys actually read, so I'm cheating. But
oh, please do.
It's from an essay called Morality as a System of Hypothetical Imperatives. If a hypothetical use of should gives a hypothetical imperative, and a non-hypothetical use of should gives a categorical imperative, then should statements based on the rules of etiquette or rules of a club would be categorical imperatives. Okay, so what does that mean? If we use hypothetical and categorical in this way, so if we say should in a hypothetical case gives us a hypothetical imperative then that we may or may not act in this case, and should in a descriptive or normative case, like X has the qualia of red, then it should be red, is thus a categorical imperative, then if we believe this, the rules of etiquette or rules of a club are universalizable and thus normative. And that's actually an even broader way of making the same point McIntyre is, that you basically make the arbitrary rules of a group normative with this move. Does that make sense to you guys?
Mm-hmm. I think so. I think I'm following.
So let's say, like, I define the table as black. And I say, well, this table should be black. And we're talking about a hypothetical table. Then I look at a real table and say, the real table should be black. All right. Now, my definition is socially constructed, right? We're just going to assume sure. that I don't have the Platonic form of black in my head. And therefore, me saying should in the hypothetical case, and when I encounter something in reality saying should, means that I'm actually making a normative claim. And thus, I'm making my emotive response universal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or my social response universal. Okay? So if you actually believe this, you cannot separate etiquette and morality or emotivism and prescriptivism at all. And McIntyre separately basically comes up with the same theory. Like they actually did it. I don't think they were informed of each other's work when they were writing. So like,
yeah, they were writing at the same time about the same
right,
thing.
Right. And so, yeah, I think what I was what you're talking about.
Talk about the zeitgeist.
Was like an 80 was written in like, I think it came out in 80 and this essay is from 1972. So, what do we see here? Well, we see that, like, you know, convergently, basically, two people looking at reality come up with the same problem in contemporary ethics. And I think if you look at, for example, now I am going to get all Frankfurt School-y on people for a second. The dialectic of enlightenment, when you look at the way, like, the virtues that become increasingly instrumentalized and also become mythic. So they're both instrumentalized, so we use them to as a way to use people, mm-hmm. but they're also mythic in that we justify them in ways that have no bounds to any historical anything. Take the idea of the state of nature and the social contract, which never fucking happened. Like that is a myth. And so this imperative towards reason turns in on itself again off of the same principle, because you're normifying, reifying, and mystifying at the same time. The reason why I started studying virtue ethics was a way out of that bind. But because the other way that you can get into is basically you can fall into what basically post-structuralists fall into, which is moral relativism. But if you take that to its logical conclusion, there is no way to critique anything meaningfully. Because there is no basis to critique it from.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, like, to me, like, when people worry about post-structuralism, I'm like, well, it defeats itself because, like, you can't really say anything about anything ultimately. I'm not super worried about it. So I get the thing here, though, is we still don't have a good place to ground our virtues, right? We still don't actually have a way to say what virtues we should even use as aspirations. So Chris, you seem to have wanted to get into that, particularly when like Foote talks about justice or goodness or whatever, because she does try to do it without reference to God.
Right. And then, I mean, McIntyre does this elsewhere, where he talks about sort of community ethos, really. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah. Dependent rational morality.
Right. Yeah. So, even using God as his underlying like arbiter for all things good or whatever, he still is working towards a goal of de-individualization and trying to underscore that what is good is moving towards the collectivization of, you know, mankind again, and putting the sort of thing that determines what is and isn't a virtue is something that is good for the collective, good for the community.
I'm actually gonna throw something a little bit I don't entirely agree with that because, okay, well, one of the things that I think a lot about is a collective agent problem.
You've been thinking about this a lot longer than me.
Well, I mean, this is also something I think about in terms of communism. So, for example, one thing you can have with a collective agent problem, if you posit a collective agent, you can actually have a collective thing where it's good for the collective agency as a whole and bad for every single member of it.
okay.
You can. Yeah. And, like, there are studies on, for example, like, unions and workers' movements where, like, people were making sacrifices for the collective worker that was bad for every single worker involved, and ultimately because of that kills the collective. So it is immediately rational for the collective to do, but not long-term rational because it is irrational for all of its constituent members.
That's so, basically Steinbeck's In Dubious Battle.
Right. So what actually I think what McIntyre is trying to do is not so much say we have to collectivize.
Man, that's blowing my mind. I got to say, that's blowing a hole in my mind. Holy shit.
So McIntyre is not saying we need to posit a collective to which we all, like the collective humanity to which we all build. No, we can't separate even the collective of individual that clearly. So if the individual is striving, the collective is also flourishing. Actually, if I'm really technical, the serial being is also flourishing. The serial, which is everyone involved in the category.
Okay.
And that they're informing each other the entire time. So you don't have the collective individual split, which is really what he's trying to get at. So instead of positing the collective against the individual or the individual against the collective, you see them as mutually dependent, and both their flourishing are dependent upon each other. If society is sick, the individual is sick, and vice versa.
Right. Or you could say that the free development of each is the precondition for the free development of all.
Bing, bing, bing. like this is why Marx's conception of freedom like fucks with people's head so much, because it does not subordinate the individual, nor does it prioritize the individual solely. And that is not something we're used to. Like, it is a non-zero-sum ethics between me as a point in a system that has total agency and the system in which we all coexist, because we actually don't really exist very well as individual agents. We are pretty shitty as mammals. I mean, like, I don't have claws. And
yeah, well, yeah. And talk about, you know, like mythology or whatever that you're saying. Like, there is no, there is no historical point where individuals existed and then came together into a society, but for mutual aid and benefit. It always has been. It always already has been social. The human animal has been.
But Marx's that whole concept is a pre-Enlightenment idea.
That's part of why my currently uninvestigated and unchallenged and untested idea is that Marx is both, like, you know, possible because of the Enlightenment, but is not an Enlightenment figure, or not somebody who carries forward the banner of the Enlightenment.
It's very much so like the way that a person would view themselves as a member of Christendom, but also like the individual, you know, like it's like Marx's concept of the individual here and his relationship to the collective is the same as the Christian to the church in pre-Enlightenment period.
Right. So I am part of this, like, to get really into medieval philosophy and into late antique philosophy. I am part of the body of the polis. I am part of the body of Christ. I am part of so both.
Yeah.
The metaphor there being that I am both a personal body and part of a body, which is a living organic thing. Even if it's only metaphorical, because, you know, that's how we think. But
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, to me, like, I this is actually from a fucking lame ass social democrat, but I think he was actually right. Marx is the Marx is the loyal opposition to modernity.
Loyal opposition to modernity. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm prepared to accept that.
That he does not want to undo all of modernity. Like, we don't want to go back to feudal subjectivity and sovereignty and that sort of, like, it basically underlying mode is mystification and power. You know, when you really think about the way the feudal world actually worked, what we're describing as the ideal is more of its thought imaginary than its actual functioning. Like, the church didn't actually function this way, but this is the way everybody thought it should function.
Right. If you have any layperson now, this is the way that they think it used to function, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, and the way people would have understood this at the time, this is to which we are building, which we can only experience in basically after Armageddon. But, like, we are a pale shadow of this body now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Marx would talk about how this is an ideological trap, blah, blah, blah. But he would still basically kind of have the same concept of ideal good would be under communism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this opens us up to all kinds of attacks from, like, Nietzschean. And by the way, like, if people are afraid of the Christian right, wait till they see the non-Christian right that's coming. But the whole Nietzschean thing where, like, Marxists are really all crypto Christians, like,
Chad, yes.
In some
describe
ways,
some more memes, Chris. You gotta get some more memes in that you can describe.
I mean, we haven't described very many memes in this
and in some mistake. Ways I think it's transparently not true, but I do think there is a sense in which this idea that, I mean, even look at Marx's, like, schemata for historical development, which I actually think is problematic, but, like, look at it. Where do you begin? Primitive communism. Where do you end? Communism.
Right. I think that's, like, that's so easily overlooked, and yet it's so important because, you know, again, it's one of those things that I think is just Marx as a Hegelian is just taken for granted for a while. Mm-hmm. But he's trying to arrive at a higher order of something, and he thinks that that's where human society is. That's the trajectory we're on. And then somewhere along the way, we kind of forgot that. And then we just think, we just start talking about, like, it was bad and it got a little bit better, then it'll get a little bit better still. And eventually it will get good.
I mean, well, if you look at
the original, the true return to monkey.
Yes. The true return to monkey is cyber monkey.
If you look at, for example, and this I'm going to deviate from Marxist schemas and go into anthropological ones, because there are some ways in which Marxism just, like, picks up some just so stories from Adam Smith whole cloth because of the imminent critique it's doing. The primitive communism thing, Marx has actually interestingly been kind of vindicated by anthropology in that, for example, barter doesn't exist within group societies. It exists between them.
Right.
Like, you don't have a case where individuals bartered in ancient societies. They don't, that doesn't seem to happen. People shared shit. Like, where barter occurs is where there's a lack of social trust, and that occurs between groups that, like, encounter each other, don't share a language or whatever. In those cases, you do have barter or you have war, but in general, people shared stuff. But the thing that causes the breakdown of the sharing ethos in anthropological terms is the existence of surplus.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the interesting, like, some wackadoos like Bataille actually kind of tripped over something true. Bataille is one of my favorite crazy people. But like, he comes to some truth about religion and comes, but the surplus thing, he's actually dead on. Dead surplus creates the ability for people to hoard and create kinds of class societies. You don't really have it in hunter-gatherer societies. Unless they live in an area that just weirdly generates a lot of surplus, because, like, you can dry fish or something. That's the examples that you have it in our examples of hunter-gatherer societies. You do have it in mid-early agriculture, and the ability to create surplus. But what Marx wants to say is, like, okay, the surplus has been tying us down this whole time, but it also gives us the ability to, I don't know, have medicine, not die at 25, and, you know, women don't have to die in childbirth as much anymore. Like, we have the surplus to do stuff with this. Eventually, the idea is we can use this surplus to go back to the kinds of cooperation by re-socializing the surplus and not allowing it to be privatized. Right. Because the privatization of surplus is the creation of modes of production and thus the creation of a class society. And the virtues that justify that and the entire metaphysical frameworks that justify that do seem to kind of always kind of coincide. Like, for example, the individualist view of the soul and property ownership and individual versus collective rights seem to emerge from this time period. Now, this is also something I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know how the hell you prove this. Like, I have no idea how you scientifically prove this at all. Because there are other, like, looking at the historical evidence, this is both underdetermining and overdetermining simultaneously. But I suspect that's what Marx basically believes. And so virtue ethics as a kind of is emergent from more old forms of thought. Mm-hmm, I mean, right. it is related to a pre-capitalist worldview.
It is right. I mean, that's when Engels commenting on the anthropology of his time. He sort of, it's not exactly right, but he looks at like the Iroquois civilization, and he's like, that's basically how we used to be before modernity fucked it all up. And we can get there again.
Oh, Marxist Genesis we're talking about?
Well, yeah, that's kind of the point I was trying to make about, you know, Marx as a Hegelian it's really difficult to not see it when you think about it that way, because the entire project of scientific socialism is resurrecting, you know, the man in his natural state, but on the higher basis of production, so that we don't have to worry about like famines and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would actually say the claim is maybe even bigger than that. It is to obliviate the separation between man and nature in the first place.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's important. That's, you know, of what are the kinds of alienation of man from man, or, you know, what are people from people, people from themselves and people from nature.
And Marx aims to undo some of those. I mean, there is a way in which, like, thought alienates you, and Marx, I don't think Marx thinks you're gonna get rid of that, because Hegel doesn't think you're gonna get rid of that. Like, but the basic forms of social alienation are handleable.
Right. Engels talks about conquering nature in a way that like Marx doesn't, which is
Well, Engels has a tendency towards positivism that Marx is more sketchy on.
Right. I think if we could establish some Marxist virtue ethics, that we could charge Engels with being only partially virtuous. Or as a friend of mine likes to say, and I think it's, you know, it's a little bit tongue in cheek, and I wouldn't say it literally, but Engels is the first revisionist.
If Donald listens to this episode, he's going to start shooting steam out of his ears.
I actually, ironically, I tend to agree with Donald on the defense of Engels, but I would also say that Engels tends to broaden out all of Marx's claims.
Right. I mean, the way that I would put it, just to be fair and also to be clear, I think that Engels and Marx are part of the same project. They have different ideas, not exclusively, but somewhat in some areas.
They have some different ideas. Yeah.
Yeah. It's why it's important that, you know, the term Marxism is with us. It's not a very good one. You know, scientific socialism, modern communism is full of people with a million different kind of ideas. But then,
yeah, I was going to say, all those are even vaguer.
Yeah. They are, but Marxism, because of the specific, because it's attached to a person's name, it problematizes every new idea, every contradictory idea, every development, every disagreement, because you know, Marx and Engels have those as collaborators. Mm-hmm. And Engels is the person who most fully develops Marx's thought after he dies until other people do, right? But because it's Marx's thought, every single new addition or subtraction or whatever is up for debate as whether or not it is Marxist. When the only real question ought to be is it in service of the project of communism?
And or is it true?
Well, sure, sure.
True is good.
And is it virtuous?
Yeah.
We're adding that one back in.
Yeah.
Is
it virtuous? Is it in service of communism?
I would say
in that order, those are the three questions.
I would say the other reasons I got obsessed with virtue ethics and reduced to communism is this breaks us all the way back to the beginning and why I think it's important, maybe not in a philosophical way. A lot of Marxists, I'm going to be honest, are suboptimal human beings. So, like...
Present company excluded, of course.
Not all.
Optimal human beings.
And by that, I mean... When you're not attracted to Marxism in service of a workers' movement that is alive at the time in which you are actively participating, and in often cases it's not. I mean, Donald Parkinson over there at Cosmonaut would actually agree with the EndNotes people. So they think the only thing they agree on is party communism actually emerges when the workers' movement is weak, not when it's strong. He sees this as a good thing. The communizers see this as a bad thing. I kind of shrug. But the point in that is that, what attracts you to a philosophy like this when you're out of step with your own society, from the community nature in which we actually live, in which these virtue ethics emerge, is that you're doubly alienated. You're not just normal levels of alienated, you're additionally alienated. You're kind of a fucking weirdo and you're probably a little bit broken. And that's okay, actually. As Marx,
we're all canceled.
Listen, I've been canceled. Hell, we've all been canceled.
I think everybody here's been canceled.
I'm gonna add a little bit of, like, I'm not normally a forgiving sort of person. People who deal with me online probably know this.
Surprising to me for some reason.
But I would say that my purpose in bringing this up is not that we should expect people who come to our movement to be in the best possible optimal performing level, the fully actualized super communist, because at this point in our movement, and maybe it's better now. I mean, it's better now than it was in, say, 2005. You're probably a marginal weirdo. And so, like, and I think one of the reasons why our movement is more popular right now is not because there are less marginal weirdos. It's because there are more of them.
I was going to say, there's definitely more marginal weirdos now than maybe ever before.
Right. And so part of our project should be not just to bring about communism, because we can't bring it about with a broken fucking subject. Like, we cannot valorize the worst habits of people as they are. We have to be able to impair them not just with a vision of the future, but also with the interpersonal social skills and powers and basic ethics and norms to function. And if we cannot do that, we are just a distraction for a bunch of weirdos. So, like, I'm okay with that. I'm okay that we attract a bunch of weirdos. I think that is great. We need to offer them, as former weirdos ourselves, maybe still active weirdos, we need to offer them more than, you know, the ability to project upon a future state which they cannot yet enact. We need to help them become functional fucking adults.
Virtuous, so, like, people, perhaps. Virtuous, right. People, one might say.
I would say that one of the most irresponsible and destructive things that the ISO did was congregate a bunch of weirdos, give them, like, the fire of God in their bellies, and then have them read Their Morals and Ours by Leon Trotsky.
Oh, God.
and then unleash them on the world as that. Because, yeah. You know, what the earlier when... fucking forget who said it. Actually, it's both. It was Varn and Kevin. You were talking about the woke and unwoke mm-hmm. crowds on the left and how they're both twin sides of the same problem. It's a twin hydra or whatever. Mm-hmm. There is the material expression of this problem here, because the unwoke people are trying to make a normie socialism so that it can become attractive to the not broken, not weird people. And the woke people are trying to make everybody else broken and weird. And they're both wrong, right? Because what they don't have is a conceptualization of, and this is one of the things that I think is one of the reasons why I'm always referring back to De Boer, and it's not just because of the concept of spectacle, but it's a concept of alienation, is that, you know, our political form, that is to say the structures, however conceived of the movement, have to inculcate within us something that is at least the aspiration of becoming, you know, even if we can't fully achieve it until whatever the revolution, until the process of mass struggle makes the proletariat fit to rule. There has to be something in between going to church, going to work, and going to sleep on one hand, and the revolution on the other hand. Like the internal life of the movement, the party, whatever, has to be conceived of as something that makes you better and makes you want to be better.
Yeah, I used to talk about this. If you believe in revolution, you have a moral duty to better yourself. And if you don't, you're betraying your aspirational goals. And people thought I was like being super harsh and mean. And I've been accused of being ableist too, for saying this kind of stuff. And I don't want to actually, one of the things I hate, just to get into that, is the demonizing of actual disability struggles because of people using ableism stupidly. So just want to get that out there.
Hey, saying stupidly is ableist.
God damn it.
What did we decide today?
So we decided virtue ethics is a compatible morality with communism, with the exception of we still have no way to decide what virtues we should use are. But to this, I'd say we can't have a reductive rule, but we do need a couple of principles. Mm-hmm. And like I always tell people that in my politics, my goal is eventual class abolition.
Yes.
Like that is my teleological orientation. And everything else is negotiable but that. If you mess with that, then I'm done with you. And like the virtues have to be aimed at that. What does that look like? And if that's our goal, that's our political goal, the virtues in our political movement have to be aligned with that. So, for example, innate hierarchical virtues that imply innate hierarchy, even if it's biologically in humans, all right? I'll actually argue that it might be.
What, hierarchy?
That we have hierarchical tendencies in our biology.
Oh, yeah, I mean, maybe I don't really care that much.
Well, but that's my point. It doesn't matter if we do, right? Because we're not right. We are not conflating is and ought. And if you actually study the anthropology of this, there are societies that dampen that. So you look at you look at things that exist. You model things that you can exist that exist in the past or now. But that's the other thing about virtue ethics, is it is based on modeling things where you have seen this before, but knowing that the results might be different than anything you've seen before. Particularly when you combine them together. So like what are high egalitarian, high free societies look like? How do you deal with surplus and productive differences? How do you make something more, is even like, for example, almost all the lessons I know assume democracy is necessarily egalitarian, which I don't know that I actually believe. But how do you make a society more egalitarian? Is that democratic? Is it sortition? Is it, you know, like, and then you figure out the principles, you figure out principles of which operate that. And the other thing is like, for example, there are principles that are overarching that you might see as human universals in their generic form, justice, freedom, egalitarianism, but in their specificity vary dramatically from culture to culture. So right. You might talk about like there's a universal impulse towards justice, but it looks radically different from society to society. What is the principal thing that makes it? What is the family resemblance? Use Wittgensteinian language is not going to really fuck you up, but bringing another philosophy set in here. But that we can.
I'm already pretty fucked up, man. I don't know if I can take it.
But what are the family resemblance that we can see something like justice from? What is universal and what would be particular to our society? And then we try to define that from that emergent set of criterion. This is another thing about Marxism that is maddening, but also like something to think about. Marx doesn't axiomatically define anything ever. Even like capitalism and proletariat, they're not defined. They're described.
It's true. Yeah.
Like,
I don't find that infuriating.
Well, a lot of people do. Like,
yeah.
I mean, just as a working model, Thomas Aquinas's virtues map pretty well on top of everything that we're talking about. You just have to adapt those to be in service of, you know, the greater good of humanity rather than, you know, the body of Christ.
Humanity is the body of Christ.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, there's no distinction there other than terminological.
Well, faith is one of them, and I don't necessarily know how you have secular faith unless it's just in the project of human emancipation.
And chastity is another one, and have fun with that.
It's temperance, not chastity. Temperance, not chastity.
Oh, excuse me.
Either way.
No, temperance is a good idea. That's something that all leftists need to learn.
Yeah, right.
If you've ever been to like a socialism conference and witnessed the debauchery and consequences then you understand that temperance is a virtue that we all need to cultivate.
You know what's really funny is this shouldn't stay in, but I'm just thinking about the culture of the ISO that where I come from and the political the internal social culture of the ISO for the fucking 12 years I was a member, and then the political culture, of left right now. And it's like that group had to dissolve when it did, because otherwise it'd be dissolving now instead, because it was very much like a party culture, you know, like
it's a hedonism circus.
It was extremely, it was a hedonism circus. Yeah. And, you know, because it was college. That's what it was.
Party in class, man.
How do we conclude?
We conclude without a conclusion.
We do like the end of War Pigs. It's just like,
I mean, we just talked about like, I guess like figuring out what our teleological orientation is and picking traits that you could turn into virtues and picking the relevant traits of virtues that already exist. That is a thing you can do. But as to what they are, I can't do that on my own. Like that would be methodological individual. I mean, actually,
yeah, no, you're right.
Methodological
you're right.
Individualism, but that would be deeply individualistic in a problematic way.
Like, right. No, I guess you're right. The point is to make the appeal that this is one of the things that we have to take on. This isn't the prescription. This isn't a manifesto. This is like let's all actually start thinking about this, you know, for the first time.
Yeah, I mean,
that's as far as we can go with a single conversation, anyways.
Fuck, we didn't get to solve it.
More. Witness this pair in a comfort. Lethargic, unconscious, no brows bowed in question, complacent, completing their tasks. No questions asked. Consider this critic a cretin, resting on laurels completely invented. Word acrobatics performed with a harness and net. I'm so full of shit. But I will remain till this self-awareness fades, till I defeat the purpose served by this soapbox that you made. That you made. Hope perseverance, a vision sucked out. Greening got 2-6, a bad case of big mouth. A sum of our parts, and I've never laughed harder. A song in our hearts, and I've never laughed harder. It don't really matter, cause nothing's ever felt as right as this. By the way, I stole this riff. Does that laugh at play? Another message we convey. It seems we're only here to entertain. A rebellion cuts a fit.